child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier.
I saw a post on Facebook by James Gunn.
Yeah. I'm waiting.
Oh, I thought you were getting... No, it wasn't...
Chomping gum?
It wasn't a Facebook Live video. He was posting an article, or a study, actually, that was conducted by a financial services comparison site called Go Compare.
Okay.
That is desperate for clicks. Apparently, they just need... They're just looking for clicks. Is there any kind of clicks they can get? Try Rihanna. That's my advice to them. But
yes.
And they put together a study about the films with the most on-screen deaths.
Oh. Okay.
And the reason that James Gunn was posting it is because apparently, according to their estimation, Guardians of the Galaxy has the most on-screen deaths of any film ever.
Really?
Yes.
That doesn't seem likely to me.
They gathered their information from a couple different sites. A site called YouTube. We'll have to check that out. Twine, Movie Body Counts, and a site called All Out of Bubblegum. So that's probably a site that James Gunn keeps his eye on. But for now, I think he's set.
For sure.
He's set. And they said that Guardians of the Galaxy features 83,871 fatalities.
What?
Yes.
That is an absurdly large number.
The number two runner-up is Dracula Untold with 5,687.
Seriously?
Yes.
That is insane. I don't think there are that many on-screen deaths. There might be suggested deaths.
In Guardians?
Yeah.
I think they're attributing it mostly to all the Nova Pilot ships that blow up when the Dark Aster, like...
They have to. That's gotta be it. So but somebody, how do they know how many Nova Pilots?
Well, somebody at All Out of Bubblegum, I'm here to count Nova ships and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, my God.
Either counted them or just, you know, looked at... you know, the design, probably watched one of the special features that says how many ships there were or something like that, and came up with around 80,000. And of course, that doesn't count all the other soldiers or whoever that died in the film, or the Sicarians and that sort of thing.
Right.
Now, right off the bat, any nerd worth his or her salt is like, Alderaan? Hello? I can think of a bigger one.
Yeah.
But apparently that doesn't count because it's not like explicitly seen. Although we don't see all those pilots die. They just die in an explosion. And I'd argue that the inhabitants of Alderaan died in an explosion.
Yes.
That's how they died.
Exactly.
But that doesn't count.
Okay.
Yes. They have to be, according to the site, quote, very heavily implied dead. So when, I hate to grind this particular vibro axe, but when Obi-Wan Kenobi says, as if millions of us cut out says, I guess they were silenced. Like,
and they weren't really millions of voices. Maybe like Obi-Wan was really exaggerating.
Die.
Yeah.
They were just, you know, they were chewing gum in school and they were told to be quiet. And so.
As they exploded.
Some of the other choices on the list, Avengers, Marvel's The Avengers was at number 10 with 2,012 deaths.
Okay.
Again, just thinking about it, I'm hard pressed to find a dozen deaths in Avengers. Loki, like... kills, you can pretty much assume that he kills a bunch of soldiers at the beginning. Some cars and stuff blow up, but you never see like anybody die except for
the random alien Chitauris. Guys.
Yeah.
But that must be what they're counting.
Okay, I don't know. Some other selections, Thor the Dark World was number 46 with 331. Looking at other comic book movies, I guess, Captain America the First Avenger at number 130 with 201. Age of Ultron, surprisingly low at number 170 with 168 deaths. And Watchmen was at 179 with 160. I want to know which one was the closest. Which one was the Fahrenheit and the negative 40, where Fahrenheit and Celsius.
Right.
It was like number 165 with 165.
Yes.
I want to know that one.
Yeah.
But the full list can be found. It goes all the way to 653 on the Go Compare website.
Oh, wow. Okay.
People get paid to do that.
That's kind of crazy that people get paid to do that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, it was like an Apatow film where they were starting a website on like how many boobs you saw in a movie. That's what it reminds me of. And you're laughing, so you must know what I'm talking about.
Well, you're imagining like dead boobs, like the most boob deaths.
Oh boy,
Showgirls, pretty rough. It was, yeah, Flesh of the Stars.
Yes.
But there's a plot point because there is a site like that already called Mr. Skin, and the guy's hearts are broken when Paul Rudd says, oh, it's like Mr. Skin. And they're like, what? There's another site that's like that already? And so, yeah, that doesn't really go anywhere, but... Yeah, just a moment of silence for all those dead boobs. But not too long. Welcome to the Just Enough Trope podcast. I'm your host, Caliban, joined as always by my co-host.
Hi, I'm Mikan Hanna.
And we're here to talk about different things.
I do not have dead
than
boobs.
That to bring you all the news that's fit to cast in the world of nerdy entertainment. Great show, and we're going to get right to it because we have a lot to do, and it is actually not a lot to do at the same time. We're going to talk a little news, and then for Comic Book Club this week, we're going to get right into it. We're going to talk about Daredevil Born Again, mm-hmm. the classic Marvel Comics storyline from 1986 about your favorite of mine, Daredevil, the blind lawyer from Hell's Kitchen. It features Frank Miller returning to the book after being gone. It takes place in what was published in 1986, which by all accounts is probably the best year of Frank Miller's life. His Annus Mirabilis, where he...
Okay.
Mirabilis?
You're looking at me. I don't know.
Where he produced Dark Knight Returns.
Okay.
In the winter and spring, Elektra Assassin in the spring and summer, and then in the late summer and fall, Daredevil Born Again.
All right.
Amongst other comic work at the time. So by all accounts, like... Some hot stuff.
Golden year.
Maybe this evening.
For Mr. Miller.
Yeah, yeah. And he right after that, I believe he went on to do Batman Year One. Completely reinvigorating Batman. So we like to talk about Alan Moore. We like to talk about different forces in the 80s that made comics what they are. But also think about he did, this is a little later, I think. Or maybe around the same time, he did Wolverine, the limited series with Chris Claremont.
Mm-hmm.
So modern comics and now modern cinema really owe a heavy, heavy debt to Frank Miller.
Absolutely.
And I think he's cashed that marker already.
Horse.
In terms of social capital, I think that he's spent all that, and he's asking us for a little more. But we're talking about the man from the 80s.
Yes.
Before it all sort of spoiled and went wrong. Yes. How are you doing? Spoiled or fresh?
I'm spoiled fresh. I'm doing well, Cal. I've been dragging all this week.
But this is not the check in to see how tired Mika is segment.
No, I know it's not. and it's like I can't for the life of me think of a logical reason why.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of bothers me.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I had some weird dreams last night. I won't go into details. They were just weird.
If you're out there and you're a GP, we need your help.
Yeah. Apparently.
Send your missives to justenoughtrope.com. Juicing.
About
what about juicing?
Juicing?
People swear by juicing.
I've never tried
I've
juicing.
Always poo-pooed, and maybe that's the problem, juicing, because it's like, all right, it's a fad. And people, you're too busy to eat your vegetables. Vegetables are good. What if you had a ton of them in liquid form? Everything in moderation, right?
Yeah, I think that's gross.
I guess
personally.
If you're real busy and you're eating cheeseburgers all the time, but you still need that kale.
Yeah.
But just go get some kale.
I suppose.
It's not going to kill you.
I know, right?
Yeah.
They were talking about...
I'm having a kale revolution. There's so many things you can do with kale.
You know what? The other day, earlier this week...
What show is this?
Yeah. Earlier this week was National Kale Day.
Oh, boy.
And they were talking about it on the radio. And the two morning hosts on The Current, they were like, they both don't like kale. But... There's somebody who wrote in and was like, and this is something that you've done, you know, I don't like kale either, she said, but she was like, you know, you just put a little olive oil and sea salt and you bake it. Mwah.
Yes.
Delicious.
The application of heat completely changes kale.
It does. It's not as tough.
I'm ready to retire. Are you?
Yeah.
I think we should just quit.
Yeah.
Let's do the news and bring this thing back.
Okay.
Well, we spoke about it on a previous show, but I wanted to do a little update. Westworld is doing great. It had a high premiere in the Nielsen ratings, which...
Not surprising at all.
Can the Nielsens get their act together and find a way to measure streaming? Because things kill on streaming.
Oh, God.
Nobody knows or they don't understand it. The companies can't follow the success, even though the audience is loving whatever is going on.
Right.
And... I'm sure they dragged their feet when they had to go from broadcast to cable, but now they've got that figured out. So come on, man, figure out some way to how many people watch it on their cell phone or whatever.
I know.
Because here's what's at stake. You selling washing machines.
Yeah.
Or tampons or whatever, yeah. Right? That if the bottom line drives it, then how come you haven't figured this out yet? You just going, I don't want to do that.
I don't want to figure out a logarithm to figure it out.
To make more
out.
Money.
Yeah.
I got that vocal cord surgery too later in the week. So, yeah, anyway, they did really great. They had 3.3 million total viewers, which is great.
Wow.
On cable. Yeah, and it matches and maybe exceeds Nickel and Dime, True Detective 3 years ago.
Nice.
The first season of True Detective, a.k.a. the good season
right.
of True Detective. Although, I can't remember if we talked about it in the show, but second season's got its merits. Not awful.
Okay, so we started watching that show, and then we kind of stopped, and then you continued without me.
Yeah.
So I haven't...
It comes back around.
I've only seen the first couple episodes of the first season. So I haven't seen the second season.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't like it. It definitely comes back around. And what it does for me, one of the reasons that I think it's so magical, this is the second season, by the way, is because it takes you... There are certain films that I call, joshingly, I don't want anybody to get hurt, but I call like set fire movies.
Wow.
Where you just cast... I won't pick on anybody in particular except the people I'm about to talk about. Actor A, B, C, and D in it. And it's like, I hate every single one of those people. And how sad it would be if somebody had a hot plate in their trailer that went awry. And this is one of those things. It's like Vince Vaughn, Taylor Kitsch, Rachel McAdams, and Colin Farrell. Four people who the collective output of their theatrical acting abilities could be matched by like any 10th grader, I think.
No, that's true.
And they all killed it. They were all perfectly cast. For the most part, Vince Vaughn was against type as, hey, I'm a crime boss type guy. But like he committed to it. And they were all really good. And yeah, the story doesn't make any sense. But it's kind of crimey and it's true-y and detective-y. More detective than true.
All right.
But but it killed the franchise. Never come back. They're talking about doing a third one, but we'll see.
Are they? Huh.
Yeah. But anyway, kudos to Westworld. If you have access to HBO, I definitely say go see it. It is almost universally well-loved. An acquaintance of mine thinks it sucks, and that's okay because I don't trust his judgment.
I think it's amazing.
Let's talk about other streaming shows. Marvel's Iron Fist has announced a release date.
Yes.
March 17th, 2017, which is rapidly approaching.
It is.
I would say sleep on it. Take your time. Make a good show.
Yeah. Don't hurry to get these things
out. Don't do it for me.
Wow.
Yeah, the synopsis is as such. 15 years after being presumed dead in a plane crash, Danny Rand mysteriously returns to New York City, determined to reclaim his birthright and family company. However, when a long-destined enemy rises in New York, this living weapon is forced to choose between his family's legacy and his duties as the Iron Fist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's got a little bit of Batman Begins-y type stuff in there.
I'm not as familiar with Iron Fist from the comics or just in general. So can you tell me, Cal, is that fairly similar to his origin story in the comics or?
Well, what they're going to do with the show, I'm not exactly sure. I'm sure that they'll play with a little bit of stuff.
Okay.
As far as the rest of it goes, I mean, do you know his origin from the comics?
No, I don't. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, he and his family like crash in the mountains in Tibet or something like that.
Okay.
And his father's killed. His mother eventually is eaten by wolves.
Awesome.
It's horrible. And they basically are, I can't remember. I'm sure that they've retconned a couple times that there's a sinister reason they're there, but it's basically just they're rich and they're traveling.
Sure.
And so they end up they crash in the mountains. He is saved by the residents of Kunlun, which is this like Shangri-La-esque mystical city in the Tibet.
That much I know.
It's like the shadow kind of a similar thing. And so then he stays there. He's raised by the residents of Kunlun and some people whose names I can't remember. And I'm not going to guess because it'll sound kind of racist if I try to guess at their names.
Okay.
But and he is raised in the ways of their kung fu magic.
Sure.
Before was racist.
Right. Well,
they're going to update all this, I hope.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is that like he wants to get or he is raised to summon this power, become the champion of Kunlun, which is the Iron Fist.
Sure.
And once you defeat the dragon, there's this dragon, this immortal dragon. If you can defeat it with your bare hands, then you get to plunge your hands into the brazier and get the ability to focus your chi to make your fist like unto a thing of iron.
Okay. All right.
So it's kind of like, I like it because his power is sort of, Well, it depends. They've done a lot with it in the recent years, but it's sort of secondary. It's just kind of an extra thing. The thing is that he's been raised for 15 years as a mountain ninja.
Sure.
And that also he can, like, punch through a car door.
Right.
But it's never like, oh, boy, I got to punch through a car door. We're not getting out of this. Like, it's just kind of an extra thing. It's a secondary thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'd be like if Batman could also see in the dark.
Okay. I feel like he can.
I bet he wishes he could. I bet he eats a lot of carrots.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of carrots.
A lot of carrots.
Yeah.
He so, wears a lot of goggles, I bet.
Yeah, right. So anyway, he is going to come back to New York. We're running out of neighborhoods here, but since he's a rich guy, it'll probably be Carnegie Hill or something like that.
Okay.
Let Daredevil slave away in Midtown. You know, he'll be up on the Upper East Side, like, punching stockbrokers or something like that.
Right, right. Beating up guys who are doing white-collar crime.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Insider trader, hold it right there.
Yeah, exactly.
How would you like a fist like unto a thing of iron on your tax returns? But for people who didn't like all the ninjas in the second season of Daredevil, I'm going to sit this one out.
Yeah.
There are going to be a lot of ninjas in this guy.
Yep.
I can feel it right now.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Hey, Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
Speaking of cities that are in trouble, the Suicide Squad saved a city.
They did?
Kind of.
Okay.
That city was pretty messed up at the end, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But it turns out that probably against David Ayer's wishes, or maybe he came to some kind of deal with Warner Brothers, they are going to release an extended cut of Suicide Squad.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It is going to feature an extra 30 minutes of footage.
Interesting.
Yes.
Is it going to be edited in any way, or?
Well, I mean, they're not just going to have the time code in the corner
That's
of the thing.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah,
it's
a cut. It'll be cut together.
Okay.
But I think that DC Warner Brothers is sort of doubling down because people hate the theatrical cuts of their films, and so the only way to save it is to. I mean, you've already sort of lost. This is a consolation prize.
Yeah.
This is not a way to win.
No.
But it seemed to be what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't it be great if they could just nail it and then maybe have a few deleted scenes on the special features of the DVD?
Right. Like, here are some things that we filmed, but they just didn't end up fitting into the film. Like, I don't know, most films.
Yeah. And there was a lot that was lost from Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
Evident in both the initial trailers they put out, and just also if you read or see any featurette on the film, there are large swaths of the movie that were just cruelly sort of scythed away to keep it on track for something. Getting somewhere.
I would be interested in seeing that. Unlike the Batman versus Superman extended cut, which I have absolutely no desire to see, I would actually watch the extended Suicide Squad.
I'd give it a shot. The thing about the BVS one is that, yeah, there was a lot of things missing. And from what I understand, I have not seen the extended cut, which is adds like an hour to it, or at least
half an hour,
or almost that. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff is stuff that's just homework. It's stuff like, yeah, okay. We assumed when we watched a movie that we had to make a lot of our own sort of narrative leaps.
Yes.
We assumed that this stuff was happening. Now you're just showing us that stuff happening. And it turns out, yeah, you taking a long time to explain your kind of boring plot is not that exciting.
No.
But that's the problem with cutting out scenes. They're never going to add anything.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Suicide Squad scenes add, because I don't think there's any way to salvage the story of what's going on in the film.
No.
But if they add more character and more fun and don't run on too long, I'd call that a value add.
I would too. I'm just kind of curious at this point to kind of see what they are.
Yeah. Hey, I know that we just left Iron Fist and Marvel TV on Netflix, but we're going to drop back in real fast.
Yep.
There's a working title for the Punisher series, which is shooting right now.
Okay, what's the title?
Punisher, or The Punisher, Crime.
Is there a semicolon?
No, it's Punisher Crime.
Not Crime and Punishment.
Crime and Punisher. Oh, somebody's done
better,
that. Somebody, Denny O'Neill, or somebody's done that already. There's no way. Yeah, so it's shooting right now. There's no release date. It'll probably be either late next year, knowing how fast they put these out, or probably 2018. There's been set photos seen of John Barenthal with a beard, so maybe we're going to get like a Punisher, you know, fishing, like retirement Punisher.
Okay.
And he comes out of retirement.
All right.
He did find a shack full of guns at
this
the end
true.
Of Daredevil season two.
Yes.
So,
And I did see...
Just living in the gun shack. Tin roof rusted.
I did see a shot of him with the double D's for Daredevil in the background.
No, we're done with the boobs.
I don't know. I'm just the double D is Daredevil's symbol.
Yes.
Anyways, so people are surmising or guessing from that he most likely will make an appearance in the Punisher series.
That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Charlie Cox is somebody who I feel, he probably feels too, was going to have a bigger career up to this point.
Yeah.
He's done a little bit, but he hasn't done a whole lot.
No.
He's in one episode of Downton Abbey.
One.
He's probably, and I bet his agent, like, every year wrote the producers again and was like, could we bring Prince Hum Hum back?
Yeah, I know, right?
No, I got nothing.
Uh-uh.
First episode,
kind of an ass, and then gone.
Yep. So did the Indian prince guy, too. Probably Ooh. Wanted to get... That'd be tough.
That would be really
Inside
tough.
Inside Downton Abbey humor.
Yeah.
speaking of the titles of comic book-related things, we have a title for the third Wolverine film, which is, I believe, done shooting. They are done with this thing. It's in the can.
Okay.
And it's going to be called Logan.
How exciting.
Well, I think I said something about this when we talked about this last, that the plot line... that pretty much everybody knows they're doing or is sure they're doing is the Old Man Logan storyline by Mark Miller. But
they can't call it Old
Man. Old
doesn't
Man test
Logan.
Well when you're trying to sell it to 1835. Nobody wants to see an old man.
No.
Except they'll watch Clint Eastwood movies. So so they cut that out and now it's just Logan. And you're like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like if there was a Cyclops movie and there never will be. And they just called it Scott.
Yeah. It's weird.
It's called Slim. That's what they should call it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway, they are combining Weapon X elements, of course, Old Man Logan, and I believe this isn't confirmed, but it's heavily rumored that X-23, the female clone of Logan, will be featured in it. And in the sort of teaser poster we've received, there is Logan's clawed hand being held by a child's hand.
Okay. So we think that's the female
I would think
clone.
So. Because if he's going to quit... I mean, you can recast him for sure, but what if you had a storyline where he nurtures a little girl that he doesn't want to, he feels responsible because she was made from his DNA, and he raises her up to be the best there is at what she does.
Right.
Which is work in telemarketing sales.
Ooh, boy.
And what she does isn't very nice.
No. And then he can move on to running Xavier's school when Xavier is gone, like in the comics.
Yeah, except... We can't have Hugh Jackman just out there in the ether, right? He's going to die.
I don't know.
He'll
man.
Die.
You think?
He's kind of like, what was I thinking of? There are a lot of action heroes that just can't ever lose.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think there's a Schwarzenegger movie or two, isn't there? Help me out if you can.
Okay, I'll try.
Where, like, to win, he has to die. Like, well, Terminator 2.
Yeah.
He goes right into the lava, gone.
Yeah.
Thumbs up. Spoilers.
Yeah.
But usually, no matter what it is, like, he has to come out on top. Mm-hmm. And Jackman is totally the same way. I can't imagine him being a hero in a movie and then, okay, it's Les Mis. That's different. you know what I mean? Like, he always has to be like, I don't know, a little peck flex, and then he walks away and that's the end.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't look at explosions. So, I don't know. Maybe finally with him putting the character down, they will let this character... go off into the sunset, you know, figuratively or literally.
Okay.
Because throwing him into the sun is the only way you can kill him at this point. A little bit of comic news real fast. Wildstorm, the imprint from Image Comics that was started by Jim Lee, is returning as a DC imprint.
Huh.
They were bought by DC in 1999, as we discussed when we talked about Tom Strong.
Oh, that, yep. Mm-hmm.
Mostly as a goof to trick Alan Moore into working for DC again.
Yes.
And they are going to be revived with DC under the direction of Warren Ellis.
Okay. Interesting.
He's going to write the core Wildstorm title and serve as a quote-unquote curator of the other books.
Okay.
I think it's like a pay bump if you call somebody an editor-in-chief or like a supervising editor.
Yeah.
So he's going to be the curator.
Okay. Wow. That's really lame. Well, that could be good. I don't know. Your thoughts, Cal?
My thoughts are move forward.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, my thoughts are Jim Lee has enough power now that he's gotten Wildstorm rebooted under... Because he was at Wildstorm.
Yes.
So he grew up at Marvel, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
started his own, you know, Homage Studios.
Right.
Started the Wildstorm line within Image Comics when he and the Image 7 created Image. You've seen the Image Revolution.
Yes.
Then went corporate, turned around, sold it back to DC.
Yep.
Because he really wanted to draw Batman. And then moved his way up. And I don't know his title now, but he's like number two right under... Or he's like sharing like number two with Jeff Johns under Dan DiDio.
Oh, okay.
Actually, no. Like Dan DiDio and Jeff Johns are probably like sharing one, and then he's like number two.
Okay. Sure. Some.
This would be like if
some wave of power between the three of them. Well, it'd be like if of power.
Yeah, it'd be like if like Valiant Comics hired Eric Larson to do something something, and then he eventually like, and now we're gonna do Savage Dragon number one at Valiant.
Right.
Yeah. So I think we're going to see Jim Lee. It's going to be real tough for him to resist.
His jam hands drawing are going to be all over.
Yeah, drawing some Grifter.
Yeah.
Doing a Wildcats book.
Uh-huh.
And my thing is, we've rebooted the Wildcats like four or five times now. It was even Alan Moore took a shot at it. Like, it's been a good run. It's been fine.
Yeah.
You need new characters. Trust me.
Yes.
Like, DC's doing a lot of interesting things with Rebirth right now. They're making a lot of great changes that it's going to take at least a couple of years for them to undo.
Oh, and they will.
But why bring Wildcats and Cyber Force? I guess that's Top Cow. But anyway, you know, why bring like this tiny Mr. Majestic, this tiny slice of this universe back?
Well, I think you've already hit the nail on the head. It's because Lee wanted it back.
Yeah, and it's the perfect sort of, it's tough. Oh, it's definitely tough to create a totally new hero and get people into it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of like this is probably the right one. Don't reboot Flash, for instance, because it's huge. Why remake Gone with the Wind?
Right.
Remake something that, you know, Diabolique or something like that. And they did, and it failed. But anyway, remake something that is lesser known, but does have brand recognition. You could almost definitely sell a Grifter book, good or bad, and maybe it'll be good. But it's like everybody started wearing 80s fashion, and you're like, no, why are we going back to that? For me, that's what this is. It's like now everybody wants to do... Valiant is back. Valiant is making movie deals.
Uh-huh.
I got to see Bloodshot and Ninjak on the cover of comic books now. Like, what year is it?
I wasn't into comics in the 80s.
You didn't have the foil embossed hologram gatefold covers?
I did not. You are correct, sir.
Here's a trend that really pissed me off. For a while, comic books went sideways.
I think that would
make me turn it like a Playboy centerfold. And then you'd read it like top to bottom like that?
Besides it just being freaking annoying, wouldn't you also kind of feel like you're reading something dirty even though it's like superheroes just like punching each other?
You bring to it what you want.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
All right.
One more comic story and then we're out. Neil Gaiman's American Gods is coming to comics in 2017.
Okay.
Courtesy of Dark Horse.
All right.
Huh.
I guess that makes sense.
A better deal than...
Than...
DC?
I guess.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Interesting.
Is he writing it?
Well, he's already written it.
Oh. Okay.
Of course. It's going to be written by Pete Craig Russell. You know, the famous illustrator?
What?
Yeah. Well, this isn't the first time that Russell has adapted some of his comics, Gaiman's comics, to from book to page.
Uh-huh.
He did Coraline, I think, as well.
Oh, yeah.
And the Graveyard book.
Mm-hmm.
And he's worked with him as an artist. He drew, I think maybe just one issue of The Sandman. But I think they've collaborated on other stuff like Murder Mysteries.
Okay.
I think they did a graphic version of that short story about like the angel. It's complicated.
Okay, it's fine.
It's in like Angels and Visitations.
Sure.
Just look it up.
All right.
But it's not going to be illustrated by Pete Craig Russell, which is good because it would never ever, we'd all be dead before it was finished.
Okay.
It's going to be drawn by Scott Hampton and it'll have cover art from Glenn Fabry and Adam Brown.
All right. I read his Coraline. I didn't realize it when I picked it up that wasn't thinking that Neil Gaiman's Coraline is a novel for kids, not a graphic novel.
Right.
I read the graphic novel.
Okay.
Yeah. I kind of wish I hadn't done that because now I was just kind of like, meh. And I'm not sure if he illustrates it or not. He might have, but it was the drawings were weird and not in a good way.
That sounds like Peter Russell, kind of like a Baroque sort of fashion.
Yeah, I mean, it just wasn't.
But needs to be fixed.
It's just yeah. Mm-hmm. It just was very simplistic.
I've never liked his stuff either.
Yeah,
I think that his stuff has it is the weird combination of very simplistic and very complicated at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think his figures are very kind of bland, but then he'll spend a minute drawing just some guy like I'm Siegfried, but then he'll spend like 2 days drawing like the filigreed
right
Rococo sort of borders around the panel
right.
or whatever.
Yeah,
and I don't think his storytelling is that strong. I think it works when it's a fairy tale thing and you're doing like a sort of dumb show, like, and then the knight went to the, like, if you imagine you're watching like a marionette show or something
yeah.
like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It has a sort of charm like that, but yeah, there are such complicated things going on. And of course, he won't be drawing it.
I know.
He won't be drawing it.
Thank God.
But I feel like if his art influence is going to be on this, I'm not very familiar with Scott Hampton's stuff. I don't know if it's going to fit American Gods.
I don't know either.
Although I'm a little worried about the TV show too, but
I'm excited about the TV show.
Are you?
Yes.
Well, that's maybe a different discussion, but these will both come out in 2017.
Of
the TV show
they
and the
will.
Comic. Yeah, and well, the comic will start in 2017, but knowing Neil Gaiman,
it won't.
I mean, they
come
literally
out continuously.
He's literally wrote the book. So, it's up to P. Craig Russell, but knowing that Gaiman is involved makes me think there's going to be 6 months in between issues.
Uh-huh.
That's I don't know.
Yeah.
Just going off of past history.
Also, just one other thing. I liked the comic better when it was called Sandman, and that is all. So
if Joseph Gordon-Levitt will have his way, well, nothing's going to happen because he's off the Sandman project.
Yeah, I know.
You know who we have to get on it?
Hmm.
Mark Wahlberg.
Why?
Because he gets things done.
He does.
He makes things happen.
I almost said Terminator. Transformers. Another Transformer
well,
movie. Because everybody wanted that.
He also saves things as well.
Yeah.
But I got this great idea. It's about this house, and there's like two sisters, and they love spiders. And there's a dude that's dressed up like a broad. And there's a guy who looks like J.K. Chesterton, you know? But he's actually the heart of the dreaming, where the sailors go when they die. But the weird thing is, Dream's Palace is also the heart of the dreaming.
So there are these siblings that are called the Endless, and their names all start with D. And so you got a dreaming and despair.
You got Denise and Dorothy and Danny Boy.
Danny Boy is my favorite.
Yeah, he lives over down the way.
Yeah. Oh, say hi to your mother for me, Danny Boy.
Where are you from? You're from like,
I don't know.
You're from like Jersey.
I'm not sure where
I'm
from.
I don't know where I'm from either. Say hi to your mother for me. You don't have a mother? Say hi to your brother for me. Oh, Destruction is missing? Oh, boy.
Something's wrong because my mind is fading. And everywhere I look, there's a dead end waiting.
Okay, Comic Book Club, let's get this started. Today we're talking about Daredevil Born Again, issues 227 to 233. But I think the graphic novel or the trade paperback that I read,
yeah.
I think you read the same one.
I did.
Has 226 in there as well.
I think so, yeah.
So we got a little extra at the beginning there. Which, interestingly enough, is co-written, or probably actually mostly written by Denny O'Neill.
Okay.
The writer on the book at the time, also the editor-in-chief of Marvel, I think. Well, he was editing at Marvel. And so he wrote on the book for a long time. He was instrumental. A lot of people talk about how Miller made it darker. You know,
sure.
Took him back from San Francisco and all the ass-grabbing good times with Black Widow out there and brought it back to its code of crime roots, or gave it some stronger crime roots. And Miller was on the book in the early 80s doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Introduced Elektra, the Hand, and a lot of those characters, Stick. And then took off for greener pastures or just to do other stuff. And Denny O'Neill came in and sort of did a yeoman's job trying to continue that sort of feel of the book. There's some Denny O'Neill stories that are pretty good.
Okay.
He's got the legs for it because he did the same on, he was an editor and writer on Batman for a long time.
Okay.
As was Miller, also sure. worked on Batman. So they are kind of cut from the same cloth in a lot of ways.
I feel like Daredevil and Batman are very similar in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, I was speaking of the creators, but, well, but yeah.
Yeah.
I think more than they both would like to admit, I think that they are, they're very similar. And maybe that means that's why they didn't get along.
Maybe.
But anyway.
Too similar?
Yeah, possibly.
Okay.
But Miller was coaxed to come back during this, like we said before, this amazing year that he had writing on comics. And he did 227 through 233. Featuring the cratering of Matt Murdock's life.
Yes.
I'm not sure how much of this was his idea or maybe just something going around the editing staff, but the pitch was, let's have the worst thing that could ever happen to a superhero happen. His archenemy finds out who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like the Green Goblin is just going to throw a pumpkin bomb at Aunt May's duplex in Queens.
Right.
This is the Kingpin. The Kingpin knows that you're his worst enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to take his time.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to pull your wings off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's going to wrap you up in the web. And he's going to watch you squirm. And that's what happens to Matt Murdock in his life. As this opens, it becomes clear, even in this first preamble issue, 226, things are not already, they're not going well.
They're not going well for Matt.
No, Matt's coming off a long slide of sort of bad incidents in his life. Heather Glenn, his girlfriend for a while, had committed suicide after her father had committed suicide.
Great.
Her father, it's a little fuzzy, was an industrialist, like a business guy.
Sure.
But he was involved in some bad stuff. I think the Purple Man got a hold of him and used him to do bad things and to torture Daredevil and Heather. And so that didn't go well. And Heather was an alcoholic. She actually dated Tony Stark for a while when he was on like a real low.
Oh,
so yeah, they were a lot of fun. They were having a lot of fun.
Wow.
Yes. And she accidentally revealed Dee Dee's secret identity to somebody when she was drunk. And so...
Really? This has already happened a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We can talk about that right now. Daredevil's secret identity, worst kept secret identity in comics.
Okay.
I mean, literally now that it's out. Like, everybody knows who he is.
Right.
But, like, not... Because they're like, you're Daredevil. He's like, no.
How could I be Daredevil?
Why is that blind man
see.
Winking at me?
Yeah.
Right. So, but this is before that, though. It was, like, a big deal.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what this revolves around. Because as we open, and let's talk real quick about that issue before 226.
Yeah, absolutely.
It features us looking at Melvin Potter, the Gladiator.
Yes.
Who was an early villain of Daredevil in the early days and has already gone through, and this was a big part of Miller's first run as well, Daredevil fighting him, but also rehabilitating him.
Yes, and making him a part of society.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a success story.
Mm-hmm.
Except when they need to, when a bad guy needs to have a costume made or the owl's out of town. Melvin goes off his meds and then becomes the Gladiator again. And
right.
So they've gone to that well quite a few times.
Okay.
But anyway, they do that here. And it's kind of a story that is really just, I mean, if this is the end of O'Brien, or O'Brien,
O'Neill's
run, it's kind of pottering to a stop. And that's all we have time for.
Wow.
No, it's kind of just coming to an end. There's a thing where he's going to, the Gladiator is off his meds. These guys are forcing him. They've kidnapped Betsy, his wife or girlfriend.
Yes.
And they're forcing him to rob things. He doesn't want to do it. And Daredevil's being a real jerk. He's really feeling sorry for himself. He is sulking in that most... Matt Murdock-y of ways.
Yeah, he's sulking on the tops of buildings in his Daredevil costume.
I know.
It reminds me of, have you seen this, like there's, I can't remember exactly how it's written, like the artist did it, but there's a bunch of superheroes like out on this ledge and it's like a brooding ledge or something like that.
Sure.
I think Batman's like the furthest out, but Daredevil is like maybe one or two people behind.
Yeah. But Daredevil is, his pity party is so big, the guest list is just one. I don't think he would have fit on that ledge for this.
No.
And he's ruminating on his life and how everything's been so crappy for him. And he's thinking about what Stick had said to him. At this point, Stick is dead, so he doesn't really know. He doesn't have anybody he can turn to. And he's thinking about everybody's betrayed him. And even in his remembrance, Stick is telling him, here's your problem, guy. You've always tried to serve everybody else. Mm-hmm. Your dad told you to be a lawyer. You became a lawyer.
Yep.
I'm telling you to fight crime and the forces of evil. You're doing that. Your girlfriend, is mad at you for this. And you're like, oh, boy. And you've never taken responsibility and control of your life and your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that is that it allows you, when your life falls apart, to blame everybody else.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny how it's kind of a clumsy story setup, but he can think that and completely ignore that information because the next few issues are all about him completely just turtling and just walling off his entire life as everything just falls apart around him.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like he just like forgets how to be a functioning human in society because he just, I mean, and it's understandable. He really does lose everything. When I was reading this issue, I was kind of, at first I was like, well, this, because I've read this before, but it's like, you know, I know the inciting incidents basically of the story is Karen Page basically selling out Daredevil's identity. And I was like, well, why is this issue included in the graphic novel? But then it made more sense when I was thinking about it because you get a lot of the background that goes through it, like you were saying with Potter, but also with Foggy, at Heather closing up the law business and everything.
Right.
And
it's at this point that they've had it pretty good for a while. The Nelson and Murdoch is in a big, you know, glassy skyscraper, and they've been doing pretty well. But a series of events have happened that have basically led to them splitting up and breaking, closing that law office, going their separate ways.
Right. And Maggie is Daredevil's, or Matt's, I should say, current girlfriend.
No, Glory.
Glory.
Yeah.
Why did I say Maggie?
Maggie is a character that comes up later.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Gloriana O'Brien.
Yes.
Who... In I'm not sure if Miller does this a lot, but Miller definitely likes to, he's got an ear for dialogue, and he lays it on thick.
Very thick.
Yes. Get the shamrocks. Get the shamrock shakes.
Yep.
Because she's Irish, everybody.
Yep, exactly. and another thing about her and Foggy is, like, he keeps trying to explain, quote-unquote, American culture to her.
Yeah.
And she was like, Foggy, we have Santa in Ireland, too. Yeah.
Well,
and
it's
I know, it keeps going on and on.
They commit to the bit. Yeah, it also sets up the very Dark Knight-esque inner monologue that you see, you know, like Batman's fighting some thugs, and he's like, there's five ways to disable this punk.
Right.
You know, three of them kill, but one hurts, or whatever. And so we get that while Dee Dee is fighting Melvin in a jewelry store or a museum or wherever they're fighting. and this section kind of reminds, maybe this was a dry run for Dark Knight Returns, or I'm getting the order mixed up again, but Dark Knight already happened. So maybe this is, to me, this is shades of like Batman and Two-Face.
Okay.
Where the first issue of Dark Knight Returns, he's trying to sort of appeal to Harvey, you know, as a person and not as Two-Face.
Yep.
And he's realizing that he keeps slipping into this thing and he can't get out, and he wonders, you know, he doesn't want to fight him, but he realizes that he might not be able to save this guy.
Sure.
I don't know. It just kind of felt like that to me.
Yeah.
But yeah, the issue wraps up. And so Gloria's on the scene. She definitely has some words for Matt, but she can never find him because he's hiding from everybody. And then we get to issue 227, subtitled Apocalypse.
Yep.
Wrong Apocalypse. Somebody get on the horn to the X-Men editors, because that's not what's going on here. And it opens immediately with Karen Page, who has not been in the book for a while.
Sure.
I believe that this whole her being a like a porn star who's strung out on heroin is horse. This is totally Miller's invention. This did not, I don't think Denny O'Neill played with this at all.
Uh-huh.
And we get it in one page.
Yep.
There's a lot of very terse, very efficient storytelling that comes both from Miller and Mazzucchelli.
Yeah.
David Mazzucchelli, artist on this. What else has Mazzucchelli done? Not a lot.
No.
He did Batman Year One.
Okay.
He has his own
likes working
graphic
with Miller.
Novel or two.
Yeah.
Asterios Polyp is one that he did a little while ago. Here's why. He's got a real job.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't think that he has to do this comic stuff really all that much because he has an actual job. He teaches like visual arts. He's an instructor at the School of Visual Arts in Manhattan.
Okay.
And it shows.
All right.
I wish that comics could make you enough money to have him in it full time and have him be, instead of a guy like Jim Lee, have him be like a mentor to a new generation of comic book artists.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's one thing that he does really well. He doesn't have like, oh, that Batman looks really cool. Oh, so many crosshatches. This guy can tell a story.
Yeah.
From panel to panel, in terms of the flow, knowing where everybody is, his facial expressions are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know exactly how the characters feel. There are things that are communicated. And Frank Miller, heavy voiceover.
Right.
A lot of internal dialogue. But there are things that are communicated without the help of text.
Absolutely.
You know exactly what's going on.
And to that, I have to mention that there was no part in this whatsoever where I had to go back and relook at something because I thought I missed something
right.
or anything like that. And I think that I agree with you. I mean, that's good storytelling.
Yeah.
And the visuals, like there's a lot of visuals in this that get repeated and everything too. Like,
yeah. Well, the very first thing that we see after we see this scene with Karen, where she essentially sells Matt Murdock's name to a guy for a hit of smack and says, this guy's Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
And we start from there. The very next page, we see Matt top down, like his bedroom, like in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like got a big bed and he's sprawled out, you know, he's in the sheets and, you know, it's a nice place. He's got a nice sort of loft. The next issue, and we'll get to it a little later, but opens up and he is sleeping on a cot in a tiny room in a Fleabag motel.
Uh-huh.
And the panel is extremely claustrophobic. He looks like a rat in a trap.
Uh-huh.
And it's huge contrast. And that theme, they don't beat it to death. Like,
no.
it continues for the next couple issues.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll get back to that. But that's all down to, you know, I'm sure Mazzucchelli's pencils and also design and Miller's plotting. But yeah, Matt Murdock wakes up and, you know, it seems like it's not going to be a bad day, except for the fact that he doesn't really talk to his girlfriend anymore. And he and his best friend, law partner, aren't really talking.
Yeah.
And
over
the course of the day, things get real bad. He reads the mail. The IRS is auditing him.
Mm-hmm.
The bank says that he hasn't paid his mortgage in 2 months.
He's like, what?
And knock, knock, you've been served. He's been accused of misconduct and perjury, and he has to go in front of a grand jury.
Yeah.
None of that stuff's good.
No. So then he goes and gets the help of Foggy to help fight his case.
Yeah. Why can't he? I know everything has to be self-contained for it to play out.
Uh-huh.
But why can't he, like, ask Tony for the money? You know?
Ooh, pride?
Well, it's pride, yeah. Throughout the entire storyline, he's isolating himself, and he wouldn't do that anyway. But it's just like, you know, one call to Natasha, she could probably backtrack all the connections of, you know, she could beat up somebody at the bank, which leads her to somebody else, and then she could just shoot Fisk in the face, and we're all done, right? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And
there's
story. I think you answered your question. Exactly. There's no story.
Right. But he decides to do a little roof dancing because he always feels better when he does that. There's a line later on that Karen says, and Mazzucchelli makes him, there's always like a hero swinging around or he's jumping across rooftops.
Yeah.
But Mazzucchelli makes it really look amazing. And she has a line, Karen, that's like, oh, when he's jumping across rooftops, he's like a god when he does that. And it's like, all right, Miller. Okay. You can go a little far. But it's funny, but you can see the influence of this work in other people's works, because that's a line that Ben Edlund stole for The Tick.
Okay.
Because The Tick talks, Tick loves jumping from building to building. He's like, I'm like a god when I do that. That's where it fits.
Sure.
I'm not sure it fits here.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
But I think it's also part of Karen being so repentant for...
Repentant?
Yes, repentant.
She idolizes
for
him.
For what... She did.
She's where Miller likes his female characters.
I know.
Beholden to the male character.
But she's in like the lowliest of lows, and especially because
but we're not there yet.
I know.
And words like, you know, across the bruise that is his mind. Is that a purple bruise? Because the prose is.
Yep.
Bury or praise? Which is it, Mark Antony? So Dee Dee finds out that this police lieutenant, Manilis, who is a 20-year veteran who's never taken money from anybody, is saying that Matt Murdock, he's the one who's saying that Matt Murdock paid a juror to lie or somebody to lie on the stand or something like that.
Yeah.
And Dee Dee goes to threaten him, basically. And we know that Matt's in dark mode, because instead of being like, what's going on? See how he
imagined me? Right.
He's immediately like, I know it was you.
Yeah.
Like, breaks into his house.
Right.
But is still able to be sort of smart about it because he threatens him and he leaves and he knows the Stoolie is going to call his boss right away.
Yeah.
And so, he calls somebody and he knows that this is connected to something, but he can't exactly figure out what it is. And Miller does a great touch, but he does it so smoothly you don't know he's doing it, and then he does it for the rest of the book and just pulls you along, which is he has that sort of noirish stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like Kerouac sort of. Well, not Kerouac. It's not Hef Cats and Knick Knack Paddywhack, but
right.
But it's that sort of there was steam on the streets and the rain was
yes, very Batman esque.
But
well.
Yeah, but it's not even that's the omniscient narrator. But then mm-hmm. he has that slowly morph into a character's internal monologue.
Yes,
because it'd be like streets that you know are gonna be under my heel. The Kingpin thinks. Why would that lawyer ever think that he could? And he goes right from the omniscient narrator into
yes.
Kingpin without changing the text boxes or the yes. color of them. Although, as far as the letterer goes, Ben Urich has very specific, you know yes. he's talking in his internal monologue.
Absolutely.
Because it's like newsprint type,
yeah. mm-hmm.
which I thought was an interesting touch.
I like that, actually, quite a bit. And he actually has a lot of that type of dialogue that you were talking about as well.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's sort of writing it like an article.
Mm-hmm.
But not, like, to never be published.
Right.
He doesn't write an article later, but even in his mind, he's sort of putting it in these terms, like, you know, like there's a part later on where Dee Dee is just beating everybody up, and he's like, he's negotiating a ceasefire unilaterally. All right. You should write Daredevil's Press. This is pretty good. You do.
Yeah, no kidding.
So, yeah, things don't go well. Matt ends up getting disbarred, and I think in any other comic book, they would have stretched that out for... If Bob
really
Gale wrote
time.
This, it would be six issues.
Sure.
But instead, it's a great story attack, because that's the setup.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens. This has to happen for everything else to happen. So, in four panels, Matt Murdock is not a lawyer anymore.
Yep.
Boom, boom, boom.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think that's how... All of this sort of happens. The Kingpin just is so incredibly manipulative. And
yeah, and the whole time we keep cutting back to him, and he's like, "Ooh, so good.
Yeah,
sweet like pudding.
Yeah, he's just doing a little dance in his chair.
Right. His little chubby legs are going. Yeah, over there. And there's even one point where he's like, you know, maybe I should hire him. I could use a man of his talents.
Yeah,
but I'll wait until he's you know at the very bottom.
Yes,
that's how he got rich.
Uh-huh.
You buy low. Sell high.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he's just so manipulative, and his roots go so deep. You know, he knows people all over, and he can pay people off, and everybody has a prying price.
Yeah, and we see, we didn't talk about the scene where the note that says that he's Daredevil mm-hmm. gets back to Kingpin.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a great contrast because we start off in like a dive in Tijuana or wherever mm-hmm. the hell Karen Page is, and then it goes all the way up to Kingpin on a yacht
yep.
in the Seychelles or something like that.
Right.
It's such a contrast.
And he's like in swimming trunks and yeah, stuff like yeah. that. One thing I noticed too, I just want to mention real quick. I read this a while ago, and I didn't remember... Wesley, the character Wesley, being so prominent,
uh-huh.
but he's very prominent, and he's always there, and I like that part that's like, gradually all of the henchmen leave, except for Wesley. Wesley always stays. That's why everybody's nice to Wesley.
Right. Yeah. And he tells Wesley, find everybody who's touched this envelope,
yeah.
and all their families and friends, and wait for the kill order. We're mm-hmm. gonna test this out and see if this works or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See if this holds validity, if Matt Murdock really is Daredevil.
And meanwhile, Karen's back in Mexico or wherever. Things are not going well for her.
Nope.
She's at the bottom. She looks terrible. She's like 85 pounds. And her internal monologue is this great sort of junky screed that just goes on. Where her thoughts are just completely scattered and she's
yeah.
desperate. And she says one of those things that happens a couple times in this book. One of those Miller things, which I love is great, where a character says like two crazy things and then a sane thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, she's like, I still got some of my looks. You know, maybe I could go and get a hit for that. Some of my looks. I'm just 25. She's like, she's saying, you know, it's like in Electra Assassin when he's like, find your hand, put it in the cooler, have a beer, celebrate. You're in shock, you stupid bastard. Yeah, and still not doing well. And so Matt doesn't have a job, he doesn't have any friends, no girlfriend. He's heading back to his home building, and it explodes.
Yep.
And he has absolutely nothing. But in the ruins of his destroyed building, he finds his Daredevil costume.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he knows who's behind it. This whole time, he couldn't figure out if somebody's behind this. Am I paranoid? Does everybody hate me? Is everybody out to get me? Or is there a mind? Is there somebody behind this? And that's how he knows it's the Kingpin.
Yeah.
And he says,
oh, such great work, Kingpin. You shouldn't have signed it.
Shouldn't have signed it.
Yeah. That's a great line. I mean, it just gives you chills when you read it.
And he goes right to a rat bag motel.
Yes, he does.
That's a great opening line.
All he can afford.
Yeah, the next issue, 228, titled Purgatory, very fittingly titled, he goes to a hotel, and there's a great line at the beginning in that noir tradition. And I've got $10 left in my name. I find a hotel that'll make change. It opens, and he's in this tiny, it's a splash page, but it feels so small. Mm-hmm. He's sleeping on this tiny little bed, curled up in a ball, and his mind is just racing, and it's just this loopy, crazy, William Burroughs-esque dialogue about, the people who've betrayed him. And you have to wonder, I'm sure maybe later, I can't remember, but maybe later they retcon it that he was also being poisoned with LSD. Like when Mulder went nuts in, was it the end of the second season of X-Files?
Uh-huh.
And it was revealed that the syndicate was putting LSD in his water softener or something like that. And so that's why Scully had to shoot him. But this is pretty unhinged for
It's really
for
unhinged. Yeah. And I understand him being paranoid, but he calls Foggy at one point, but then he was like, oh no, Foggy is like against me too, and blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Well, yeah, because he calls Glory's apartment,
right.
And Foggy's there.
And
he says something to Glory, we don't know what, but it makes her cry, and hangs up, and then the phone rings again, and Foggy picks up, and he's like, I'm on to you, Nelson.
It's like, whoa, where is this coming from?
And there's a great use by Mazzucchelli of this, the way that panels tell time in comics, because there'll be a long panel of him like in the bed, and you just feel how long that he's been there just sitting. And there's one particular sequence where he's like, I'm gonna get up, I'm gonna get out there, and I'm gonna go down to Kingpin's building, I'm gonna beat him up, and everybody throws me a party, and there's a big parade, and I must have fell asleep. I'm still here. That's another Miller thing where he has that sort of reverie where he uses it in Electra Assassin a lot, where a character is completely on a flight of fancy and they're yanked back into reality. Mm-hmm. And he gets up and he looks at the door, and then there's just like one panel of the doorknob, and he's like, I need more sleep. And he just lies back down and doesn't go anywhere.
I know. And I think a lot of the time while he's lying there, he's thinking, this is all just a dream. This isn't real. But a mix to his paranoia and everything. And it's just like, there's so much that has happened to him, so much that's been yanked away. It's like you really feel all of that weight, like, pressing down on him, and he feels like he can't do anything. He's completely helpless. So what does he do? He sleeps.
Yeah. And the entire time he's being observed by this lieutenant of the Kingpins, who has a very flowery, orthographical way of speaking. When he talks to him, he's got this notebook and he's writing down everything that Matt Murdock does, and the Kingpin's like, working out or something like that, and he's like, so tell me what happened. And he tells, so eventually Matt does leave the hotel. He chokes out the guy that owns it.
I know.
And he gets on the subway, and this is all revealed in flashback, essentially, but it is this henchman
who is retelling
reciting
it.
In his very drawn out way. And the way he talks is funny. It reminds me of Fat Tony on The Simpsons, because he's like a cop yells at Matt, and his description is, the command was of the constabulative variety. It sure would be a shame if something unfortunate were to happen to your lovely pizzeria.
Yes.
But he tells the story about how Matt's on the subway, and then there's like a Bernie Getz type situation where these guys come in and they're going to rob people, and he beats them all up. And then a cop is like, hey, and then he beats the cop up.
Yeah.
And he's feral at this point. And Kingpin is hard as a rock. Like, Kingpin is so excited. And he even says, he knows that Matt's on the way here to
beat him up,
to beat or kill Kingpin.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows that it's fine. And that whatever happens is going to be a decrescendo, is going to be an anticlimax compared to this. And he even says, I envy you, you worm. You've seen the death of a good man. Like, this guy, stick the horns on his head. Like, this guy is Satan.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's savoring every minute of it. And I think there was a part, too, in the last part of the book, like, he almost felt like, oh, maybe I'm doing this too fast. Maybe I shouldn't, like he's pondering not, you know, crushing him completely.
Yeah.
But then he just blows his building up anyways. So it's like...
Well, that's his... I think that's his flaw in this story. And I think that one of the things I like about him is that he is, you know, diabolical and yet still remains... We see his psychology as much as Matt's.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things that I also like is that because he's diabolical, we don't necessarily sympathize with him. He remains the bad guy.
Oh, yeah.
Something that the Netflix television show did, which I think was both beneficial and detractive, is that they really, and they've got a great actor in Vincent D'Onofrio, but they really show us a sympathetic side of Kingpin.
Yes, they do.
And you really get to know him, which is fine and all, but do it like... later, after we already know, we could cheer for the hero to take down the bad guy.
Yeah.
And then maybe in the second season, then it kind of becomes more morally complex. Mm-hmm. And like his wife gets involved, which is kind of how it happens in the comics.
Sure.
Instead, immediately they set out to have Kingpin. And you're like, okay, he was a fat kid. He likes looking at white paintings. He's got a hot wife. That's good. They're making... I never thought I would see, like, oh, it's a date scene with Fisk and Vanessa.
I know.
And I'm kind of interested to see what happens. Because that's why they have to go so crazy and have him kill Ben Urich and just have him do this turn. Which, another discussion. That's a different discussion. Okay. But anyway, at this point, he's the devil. And so Matt shows up. It's predictable. He's not in any shape to fight Kingpin.
No.
He totally takes him out. And then, like you said... he has to decide, you know, if he's going to continue savoring or if he's going to finish the meal.
Uh-huh. And, exactly.
And his flaw is he has to keep savoring it because he comes up with this elaborate plan where he's going to put Matt in a taxi cab, behind the wheel of a taxi cab, which doesn't make any sense.
No.
Because he's blind.
Yes.
With a dead cop in the back, or the cabbie in the back.
Yes.
Beaten to death with Matt's billy club.
Uh-huh.
And then they seal the doors, but in a way that makes it look like they're rusted. And then he drives off a pier where he'll drown and asphyxiate.
Yes.
And then they'll find the cab, you know, weeks or months later and be like, well, what happened here?
Yep.
And he can't wait. He can't wait until he reads in the paper that they found this cab and everything. And this takes eight panels. In eight panels, they go through this entire thing. Mm-hmm. Again, it would be two or three other scenes in a show or an issue in a book. But in eight panels, we go through, you know, at least 8 days, you know, maybe 2 weeks. Time gets played with a little bit in this because I feel like, and spoilers, they discover the cab. But I feel like that probably happens maybe midway through the next issue or like the next issue after. We have to get his reaction now because it's the perfect crescendo to the thing. But there's this long monologue that's both the omniscient narrator, but also Fisk's imaginings of the screaming and the struggling and the rage, you know, at being trapped in this situation. And then finally they find the cab and the windshield's broken. And it looks like somebody took a piece of glass from the windshield and cut the seatbelts and the ropes that were in there. It must have taken a supreme will of effort. And there is no corpse. There is no corpse. There is no corpse.
Yep. And he is so pissed about that because that means he didn't completely crush his spirit.
And that ends. That's the end of the issue. Well, there's one more panel where we see a wet Matt, you know, in shadow.
Obviously.
In an alleyway.
Yeah.
That moves into 229 titled Pariah. There is an origin story of sorts for Daredevil here. We begin immediately with him in an alley now. It's that same thing as before. It's even tighter. He's sleeping in an alley with two bums.
Yes, in the fetal position.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And we get... this is also kind of a retcon because now Miller's going to introduce the character of Maggie, who we come to learn is Dee Dee's mother.
Right.
And she comes to him in the hospital. And it always been, he's going to be strong for Dad. He's going to, you know, not tell anybody about his powers so he can use them someday. And that kind of gets prompted by him being visited by his mother. Because this woman comes to him, who isn't loud like everybody else and seems to understand him when he's blind and suffering in the hospital. And again, it's that purple prose, like, you know, they are operating on him, but the drugs don't work because, you know, his senses are too amped up. So they're basically just cutting his face and he can feel it and it's terrible. And after a while, there's a line there. It's like, after a while, the pain goes, reduces and it's only agony. It's only agony.
Agony.
Whoa.
When it cuts like a knife.
Oh boy.
Into the woods? Anybody?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right. Anyways, moving on.
And so, yeah, so that gets dropped off for later. And this is where the parallel narratives really start. there are A, Z, B, D. There's a couple different stories here.
Yeah.
This is where Ben Urich really comes onto the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of follow his story. Ben, of course, has deduced on his own, just as an investigative reporter,
right,
that Matt is Daredevil. This has happened a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
But sort of keeps his secret because he knows that he's a good guy.
Right.
And he starts sniffing out the Menelaus
really
story as well.
Yeah.
He also realizes that there's no reason for a lieutenant who is always clean to suddenly do this. And he finds out that Menelaus' son is in the hospital, has a heart condition.
Yeah, very ill.
And is very ill, and so he was doing it for the money, to pay for that, basically. But the son dies. He does not survive the operation. And immediately, Menelaus is like, I'll tell you everything.
Yeah.
Let's go. I'll tell you the whole thing.
Yeah.
And goes down. They're in the parking lot of the hospital.
Hospital, yeah.
And he's going to tell him everything. And the large attendant nurse who was in the room before shows up. And Ben's like, well, I can smoke down here, right?
Right.
Boom! She cold cocks him. She breaks every bone in Menelaus' body.
Yeah.
She breaks Urich's hand, saying, you know, if you were anybody else, we'd kill you. But you're just a reporter, just a rat.
Right.
But since we can't have you typing anything.
Yeah.
I wish that guy would be there to explain it. It would be most unfortunate if you were to type anything. So they break his hand and they scare the crap out of him.
Yep. Yeah, and she's pretty terrifying, I gotta say.
And I love Ben Urich, but one of the things I love about him is that he's a real person. Mm-hmm. He's not a superhero.
No.
And so I'm sure that he's been tested before in his career, but this terrifies
him. Really
freaking
scary.
Yeah, and it stays with him for the next couple issues and becomes his sort of running story.
Mm-hmm.
We go back to where Daredevil is, or sorry, Matt, I should say, is. And he has been he stumbles around the city. He gets stabbed by Turk in a Santa costume. Don't worry about it.
Yep.
And he ends up back at Fogwell's gym where he used to train as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And collapses, and he's found by Maggie.
Yes.
In a great, great splash page.
Mm-hmm.
That is directly is the Paeta, essentially.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yep. Mazzucchelli uses a lot of Renaissance classical influences in design.
Mm-hmm.
He uses the sort of triangle composition in a lot of his frames. He actually calls it out in one specific scene where Maggie's praying for him. And he's the perspective has his cot sort of going towards the left side. She's kneeling on the right. And then there's a cross at the apex of the triangle.
Uh-huh.
And he just, hey, if you didn't get it yet. Students.
Yeah.
It just draws a triangle. We're like, all right, we get it. But in a lot of other panels, he uses that sort of composition. He does that when Karen and Matt meet for the first time.
Yes.
And it happens a lot.
Yeah. And I think there's another really great splash page or scene, I think, at the beginning of the next issue. Where Maggie has taken Matt into some sort of, it's like a hospital
church.
With the church. And he's kind of passed out on the bed and both of his arms are open and she's praying at the side of his bed. He kind of looks like he's on a cross.
Yeah.
And I know that was done intentionally, but there's a lot of Christian imagery and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think this is still under the deadline of it being completely played out.
Okay. All right.
He's a Catholic.
Yeah, I know.
It's always been part of his story.
I know that. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I know his mom is a nun, but you know.
Yeah. And all this time, the Kingpin has just been stewing in his own juice.
Yep.
Speaking of being terrified, as much as the Kingpin can be terrified, I think he is in a similar mindset than Ben Urich. Ben Urich has been warned to forget the name Murdoch.
Yep. So every time he thinks it, he's like, no, I don't know that name. Yep. That name.
And Kingpin can think of nothing but the name Murdoch.
Mm-hmm. And Karen also keeps saying the name.
Yes, we have. Yes, that we still see Karen there. And I think it's next issue, I should know, because we just read it. But we'll get to that in a sec.
Okay.
But yeah, and we have another one of those great monologues by Kingpin / the narrator talking about how, you know, you pushed this guy to the limit and it didn't break him. And that's surprising. It's never happened before. And I've made a huge mistake. And my biggest mistake is that I've shown somebody that, you know, if you don't have any hope, you don't have any fear.
Uh-huh.
Which is
right.
Who this guy is.
Man without fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that, just to relate that back to Karen a little bit, she talks about Matt's name being her word for hope.
Mm-hmm.
So she has hope, so she has fear. I mean, she definitely has fear.
Yeah.
She's afraid for her life.
Yep, and that moves us to 230, entitled Born Again, the penultimate issue of this. Although It's the penultimate of this storyline. We'll talk about the two issues at the end. I feel like they're kind of tacked on. I feel like this could have, if you stopped this after 231,
yeah,
you would have been fine. And just picked it up somewhere else. I'm talking about when, like, Nuke comes in and all that stuff.
Yeah, I agree with
we'll
that.
We'll get to that in a sec, though.
Okay.
But 230, yeah, it opens again on Matt in the hospital, and he is fighting for life. And we kind of split it between Matt, Karen, and Fisk, sort of as we did in the last issue. And it's that same sort of thing. Karen has now hooked up with this guy that she meets who recognizes her from her films.
Great.
Named Paolo. And he's a real sleazebag.
Yep.
But he's got the junk.
Yep.
And apparently he's headed her way. He's headed into America or into New York. So she's able to hitch a ride. And she's talked about how she's sold all of her soul, but she finds one more piece, sadly, to try and get back. At this point, she wants to be with Matt. I don't think she's even thinking about that. She wants to save him. She wants to undo what she's done because she is being chased by killers now.
Yes.
There are men who are tracking her down. And there's an altercation between her and them and Paolo. She's apparently picked the right guy because these guys come in. They're like, you're coming with us. And he just starts, he opens fire. Paolo just kills these guys and now they're on the run. But not in a fun, romance and Durango kind of way.
He turns to her and he says, you better be worth
it. You better be worth it.
And it's like, ooh.
Amazing. Awesome.
Ooh.
So it continues with Yurik. He's supposed to write this story. He's been taken off the crime desk and now...
Just crazy.
I never worked for a paper, but there's like a 2 or 3 page spread, not spread, a sort of a sequence where it's the bustle of the newsroom.
Yeah.
So you've got the editor yelling at Yurik for this puff piece they've asked him for. It's taken him 3 hours. He hasn't written one paragraph.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Robbie comes in and he's like, all right, what's going on here? And he's like, Ben, are you okay? You should write this thing. In the background, you've got like, copy boy, where's the copy boy?
Yes.
And you got the photojournalist who's like, you got to buy these pictures. I've got to make rent. And it keeps doing that. Ben gets a call and he's like, well, you answer the phone. You got to write this thing. And on the other line is Lois, this nurse who beat him up, broke his hand and broke a monolith before. She's now in Monolith's hotel, his house, hospital room.
Uh-huh.
And it's another like, let me remind you what you should not be thinking about.
Uh-huh.
And she smothers Manilus while Yurik listens.
Right.
And the panels alternate in between that noise and the bustle of the newsroom with some very funny dialogue to like the sounds of a man being throttled to death.
Yeah.
And it haunts Yurik.
And Yurik describes in his monologue what it sounds like to hear him breathe his last breath.
Yep.
And it's terrible. And like everybody around him has like no idea. And they're like, oh, come on, Ben, you should get off the phone. What are you doing on the phone?
Yeah. It's great dramatic irony.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what's going on.
No.
But of course, he's afraid to say anything.
Yeah. And I think that Manilus had originally called him to tell him to confess everything. And then like, of course, you see this dark, shadowy figure come in.
Yeah.
And it could only be Lois.
Right.
So... yeah.
So in the meantime, Matt is recovering. He is getting a little better. He's sidelined in this kind of. There's a subplot where he's fighting this fever. You know, don't get stabbed and then swim in the East River. You're going to get pneumonia. You're going to get poisoned, essentially. And the fever breaks. It turns out he's okay. He's sort of getting back on his feet and he puts it two and two together. There's when he was in the hospital as a boy, a woman came to him. She had a gold cross around her neck. Now he's being taken care of by a very familiar woman with a gold cross around her neck.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks her flat out, Maggie, are you my mother?
Right.
And she's like, of course not. And he's like, she's lying.
Yep.
Because I know.
Because I can tell her heartbeat and everything.
Yep.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yep.
Yep. And then it's like not really talked about that much else in the book. Like, wouldn't he? I mean, it's great that you get this connection with your mother again, but
no, we got Nuke to deal with. It comes back.
It does, but it doesn't. Back. And then it's like, where has she been his entire life?
That all they get into that later, not in this run, but. And in the meantime, Karen is now in New York. She wants to try to find Matt, or at least find Foggy, so she can find Matt. And she attempts to do so. She and Foggy meet at a diner. And in that great art by Mazzucchelli and the words by Miller and the contrast, Foggy's like, Karen, you look great. And you can tell on his face that he is horrified. She looks awful.
Yeah.
She's, you know, underweight and Paolo's been beating on her. And she basically lays it out for him. And he's like, well, you got to come back with me. And she's like, idiot, this guy's going to kill you. He's going to kill. He'll kill us all.
Yeah.
And Foggy won't take no for an answer. He's going to take care of her because they're family.
Right.
And so she goes and stays with him. And that leads us to 231,
uh-huh,
entitled Saved. The board of the syndicate is not happy with Fisk.
No.
All he's been able to think about is
Murdoch.
Is Murdoch. He spent a lot of money on this. He spent a lot of time and resources on this. He's even gone and called in some favors, mm-hmm, from politicians, from a general.
Yes.
To maybe get some backup on this one.
Mm-hmm.
And people are wondering what's going on.
Yep.
And one of those great, you have to have one of these scenes with a Bond villain or your gangster villain. You have to have the Untouchables, you know, scene. But they're all in a...
Right.
In a sauna, and the guy's like, come on, Fisk, what are you doing? Let this blind shyster go. And he's like, oh, no, I see how you feel. Okay, okay. He's like, oh, no, I'm just kidding.
Right,
you understand me, right? He breaks the guy's neck. He's like, I'm sure we all understand each other now, don't we? How would you ever get away?
I don't know.
Could you ever get away? Do you just work for Kingpin forever, and then even if you retire with a gold watch, he shakes your hand and you go and your houseboat blows up the next day when you're in retirement?
If he doesn't think you're going to keep your mouth shut, yeah, I think
it's
so.
I'm reminded of Goldfinger where Goldfinger's laying out the plan for everybody, and the one guy's like, this is crazy! And he's like, well, you're free to go. And he goes out, gets in his car, blows up. He's like,
right.
Anybody else want to go? No? Okay. I'm just going to gas you later.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it turns out that Lois, the killer nurse, is not too happy. She's getting shipped out because even though the Kingpin still wants to do this thing, it seems like some elements of his organization.
You're making it too obvious.
Yeah. Are like, yeah, you went and killed this guy. And that's not exactly what we wanted.
You're sloppy.
Yeah. So you're going to go to Arizona and like take care of old people in Arizona, I guess.
I don't know.
Take care of?
Yeah.
So she goes rogue and she decides that she's going to kill Yurik herself. But in the meantime, Matt's
Which
back
they
on his...
don't want her to do.
No.
At all.
That's too high profile.
Yes.
Manolis was probably too high profile.
Yeah. Probably.
And so Matt's back on his feet, though, and he is on the streets now. Apparently nobody recognizes him in his puffy jacket and his three-day beard growth.
Uh-huh.
But he's a ninja. He's very sneaky.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of following the characters around, and she goes to Yurik's apartment to take care of business here.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a police guy who's coming with him. As an escort, and they go into his apartment. She's got his wife strung up in the shower.
It's so upsetting.
In the process of being hanged, and she starts beating them both up. Ben, you know, flips out, tries to grab a razor and cut his wife down. And he hears a struggle in the living room, doesn't know what's going on. He comes back out. Lois is down, unconscious, handcuffs, and he knows Matt's back.
Mm-hmm.
He's around here somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is a good sign.
It's a really good sign. That's a really cool panel, too.
Yeah.
When he puts that all together.
And I bet it's probably that triangular.
Probably. It probably is.
Meanwhile, Kingpin's plans are getting literally crazier and crazier. He wants Melvin to make a Daredevil costume.
Yes.
For a psychopath that he's gotten released from the mental hospital.
It's like, this cannot end well, Kingpin.
He needs to draw Matt out. And he's going to do that by putting a psychopath in a Daredevil costume and basically having him kill Foggy, basically.
Yeah.
And that's
going
to
get Karen, because he somehow knows that Karen is there too.
Right. He's going to get Matt out. Karen, as we mentioned, is with Foggy and she's still recovering, mm-hmm, although not really recovering. She's just full on junk sick now.
Yep.
And you know the thing about a junkie, it's like she seems pretty committed, but where's she going to fall on this one? Because she kind of started this whole thing. And she looks out the window, and she sees Paolo. He knows where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So this is bad.
She freaks out.
This is all going to come to a head. Yeah. So Fat Tony, as I've called him, is driving the psychopath to Foggy's building so he can get in there.
Yep.
And Matt's on the roof of their car.
Uh-huh.
There are a couple... Later on, what ninja? Later on, we'll talk about a sequence that I think is too rushed. This is... A lot happens in very little time.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked before about how in several panels they can really deliver something.
Right.
In fact, the first issue takes place over like a year because 6 months pass after Karen sells Matt's name out.
That's true.
And then 6 months later,
mm-hmm,
And then he tests the thing. He talks to all these people. Matt's life starts to fall apart. Like, a lot of things are pressed into one book. In one page, Matt goes from being blind lawyer of Hell's Kitchen to homeless dude.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot happens. In this, it's really rushed, but the momentum picks you up. It's like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
And Mazzucchelli is so good at these panels that normally you'd say it's too fast. You know, we want to see this guy is going to shoot at that guy ducks, returns fire. And instead, there are just these little flashes that tell the story so well because it grounds you in every single.
Mm-hmm.
And all three, four storylines are all coming together at this one point, and yet you are tracking all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
I like it too.
So they're heading there. Daredevil has got the plan now because, of course, he can hear what they're talking about.
And
my thing is, why not just stop them now? If you know a murderer is on the way to kill your friend. And Matt doesn't know Karen's there, so he just knows that this guy's going to kill. Why not just crash the car and take them out?
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. It's a story thing.
It is a story thing.
Because he wouldn't have met Karen if he didn't go.
Yeah.
He takes the guy's costume, so he's got a Daredevil costume. And that's all just part of the story.
Yeah.
But anyway, speaking of what's going on, Paolo finally attacks. He shoots out the window of the apartment, so it's on.
Yeah.
And some cops show up, and he gets in a firefight with them because he's insane.
Yeah, he is.
Worried about Karen? Well, she knocks out Foggy with a pot. And I think it's more, if Paolo gets me, he'll leave Foggy alone.
That's exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's her thinking. And then she was also like, oh, and maybe he has the junk on him. So, I mean, that's secondary.
I think that's,
but it's there.
That's in character. I think that's going to be in the back of her mind or everything she does.
Yep.
The psycho gets his Daredevil costume and his billy club and beats Fat Tony to death with it.
Yeah, because of course he does, because he's freaking psycho.
Requiescat in pace, Fat Tony. I will bring a beautiful bouquet of flowers to your funeral. And he heads up, and we're in trouble now. And he's going to open the door, like those buildings in New York, you know, that have the
roof buildings,
stair doors that go down.
Yes.
And Matt just kicks through the door and just beats the crap out of the guy, which is awesome.
It's great because we get this wonder. The cover of this singular issue is Matt Murdock beating up somebody in a Daredevil costume. And you don't really know how we're going to get there until this scene.
Yeah.
Because
is he fighting his demons?
Right. Is he fighting himself?
Yeah.
Is he fighting what he thinks of as Daredevil? That sort of thing.
And in again, there's probably another way you could have done it. It's clear that Miller came up with it and went, that's good. And it doesn't even have any horrors in it. And wanted to keep it in. It's a little impractical. It's kind of dropped off real fast. They just introduced, like, Psycho Steve or whatever his name is.
Yeah, oh. Mm-hmm.
And he's literally just a costume delivery vehicle. Because
pretty much.
Matt takes him out with very little trouble, and then we're good.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it's there. Karen is on the street now. Paolo has grabbed her and is in a full-on, like, running gun battle with the cops and Kingpin's killers as well. And he gets shot.
Mm-hmm.
And after killing the cops and then one of the Kingpin's men, and he's like, Karen, I've been shot. You got to help me. And she takes the drugs. And he's like, you stupid junkie, ripping me off. And Karen is going to do one last hit because this is it. She's going to die. You know, so at least she can die happy.
Yeah.
And there's this great economy of panels. And I don't know. You can look at it and maybe find the golden ratio or something like that. But all I know is it's those flashes of, you know, Paolo's hit. She takes the thing. We see Matt on the roof.
Yep.
The hitman takes aim, and Matt like steps on that some icicles, you know, or I think it's the hitman. No, it's the Paolo. He like hits Paolo's arm.
Yes.
And there's another guy pulls a gun. We see a billy club in midair.
Yes.
And it hits the guy's head. You know, you see Karen's eye looks up, the needle on the ground, and the next page, full splash page, Matt and Karen embracing each other. She's totally giving herself up.
Yeah.
And it's that same triangle thing, and it's like, that hits me in the chest every time. I've read this a million times, and it's just, you could not even do that today. You would turn the page, Skittles! You couldn't even do that today. You would not have that kind of editorial control.
Mm-hmm.
Or Jerry O'Connell would be trying to sell you Axe body spray or something like that. So the power of being able to conceal something when you turn the page and you reveal it exists in no other medium.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exploited perfectly here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very powerful moment. And you feel like they, both of them are kind of like saved.
Yeah.
In that moment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There was a one-page sort of wrap-up in Ben Urich's voice, and it's very sort of newsy. He's reporting on everything that happened.
All the things that were found.
Yeah. Yeah. He's reporting that some guys were dead and some weirdo was found naked on a roof.
Yep, because Matt took his costume.
Yep, and everything seems like it's going to be okay for now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think this could have ended.
Yeah, it most definitely could have.
I mean, maybe all the chickens haven't come home to roost. But the next two issues are always included in.
Yes,
because Miller basically left after this. Like, those two issues were written by him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was gone after that. And Mazzucchelli left too. I think Ditko drew it for a couple issues afterwards.
Okay.
So they are always included in the collection because that's their run.
Right.
But I kind of think the story is kind of over here.
It more or less is.
It's the climax.
Yeah.
We get two issues of Denouement, starting with 232, God and Country, where Miller's favorite pet themes really come home to roost.
Yep.
We are introduced to Nuke.
Murica.
Who is a drug-enhanced super soldier, yes, who basically just would be named Murica if he was came out today.
Yep.
Fun facts, Nuke is part of the Weapon Plus program, like Wolverine. This is all retconned. This is all retconned later.
Oh.
Technically, he is Weapon 7.
So is he...
Cap is weapon 1.
I was going to say.
And Wolvie is weapon 10. Okay. Or weapon X.
Okay.
That's the X. You thought it was a letter? Dummy.
It's the number 10.
And I think Grant Morrison's responsible for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's what I thought. He's Cap was the first. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yep. He's got an American flag painted on his face.
Tattooed.
Yep. Never mind.
Yep.
He also takes these pills.
Yes.
He's like, give me a red one.
Red, whites, and blues.
Give me a white one. Give me a blue one.
Like Mike and Ike. Ooh. You know, they do the 4th of July Mike and Ike's. That'd be good for your costume.
Go.
Give me a red. I'm going as Nuke.
Okay.
Con,
all
for
right.
Sure.
There
get the
you
flat
go.
Top ready.
Ooh.
So Urich is still on this story because we don't, you know, the aftermath is when you write the article, basically. And
mm-hmm.
so he's tracking this down. And he's got Glory working for him now.
Yes.
For the Bugle. She's his photographer. Lois is in jail. She is going to flip, like they all do.
Yep.
And Miller loves these jail assassination scenes. He loves the things where somebody's going to come in, talk to somebody, a guard on the inside, or somebody they brought with him is
crooked,
been hired as an assassin.
Yeah.
He does this in Elektra Assassin as well with Bullseye. And that's exactly what happens. Ben comes in. He brings this guy who's supposed to, I don't know if he's like working for the paper or something like that.
Because
he's
remember.
Not a cop. Anyway, but he is bad. He shoots Lois. He shoots the cops. Ben has to basically take him out and
mm-hmm.
Kill him, basically beats him to death with
basically.
His own gun. And Glory's taking pictures the entire time, which I think is awesome. Because he tells her before they go in, don't, whatever happens, you know, keep your eye on things, take pictures. And she just does.
Yep. I know. And then
they're
like,
never going to print, you can't print that.
No. Absolutely not.
But anyway, good job, Glory.
Yeah, good job.
Meanwhile, in Hell's Kitchen, Matt is taking care of Karen. He's particularly suited to, it's good to have like a live-in hospice care nurse who can hear your heartbeat and,
yeah.
you know, can smell your sweat and knows like when you need to eat and when you need to sleep and all that. And so he's been taking care of her. And, I mean, she's been through a lot. So she's very deferential to him
mm-hmm.
in a kind of weak way. Well, you kind of like her in a more modern comic, hopefully written, you know, with equality in mind. She'd be like,
yeah.
thanks. I got to get my secretary career back on track or something. But she's basically just kind of surrendered
yeah.
and doesn't do anything but lay around in bed for the next
That's
two
true.
Issues, more or less.
Yeah.
Matt has gotten a job at a diner. A diner which was referenced earlier in the story. Ben
yes.
Urich likes to come there because the food is so bad that
mm-hmm.
it's always empty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they take him there after the assassination attempt to calm down, and it's full.
And Matt
and everybody
is
loves the
flipping
food
burgers.
Because Matt's the cook.
Yeah.
Which is like, all right, Mary Sue.
I know.
He's a good cook, too.
I know.
What a catch, ladies.
Because of course he is, because all of his senses are heightened. So his sense of taste is heightened.
Right.
As well as his sense of smell.
Right.
So of course he's a good cook.
Yeah.
And he can hear when things are done.
Right.
Because his hearing is so freaking good.
Well, he doesn't even have to, like, sometimes you touch, like the burger or the meat, you know.
Yeah.
He doesn't even have to touch it. He could probably just sense how warm it is.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Exactly.
It's very versatile power set.
Yeah, it is.
And that's kind of like, it's just building action. We know that Nuke has been relocated. He's leaving this
Nam.
Jungle. He was in Nicaragua or something like that, and he just wiped out a village.
It's like he's been Nuke since Vietnam, and he just never stopped.
Yeah, and remember, this is only 20 years away from Vietnam.
That's true.
So, if even that.
Yeah.
The 80s are our 50s. So they relocate him to take out Daredevil. They're going to send him after Daredevil in Hell's Kitchen when we get to issue 233, Armageddon.
Because the Kingpin has the general...
Yes.
Where he wants it.
And his involvement in the business community and the military industrial complex. This is all commentary.
Mm-hmm.
This is all your Frank Miller sort of thing that he likes to hit. And I think it fits. It's a very 80s sort of thing to worry about. They've just taken over. We don't even worry about it now. That's my own personal commentary. And so Nuke is going to turn Hell's Kitchen into a war zone. And he does.
Yep.
They basically drop him in and he just lights the place up.
Yep.
I think they say something to him like, just make a little noise, don't worry about it. And he's shooting rockets and he's blowing things up.
Yeah.
And quick side note on Nuke, they totally blew him in the Jessica Jones show. I mean, could they bring him back now detached from Patsy, Patricia, and that whole thing? Taking the reds and the whites.
I don't know.
Could they even do that?
I don't know if they could.
I just think that maybe we could forget our connection to him.
Mm-hmm.
They spent so much time with him being like the sort of abusive boyfriend to Patsy. And I mean, if they did, like, they've already blown Born Again because you don't have a Ben Urich.
I know. I know.
But if they have Kingpin figure out, they have to do Born Again eventually on the show. Have him figure out who Matt is, destroy his life. And then you could have a action-packed climax where you drop Nuke in and Dee Dee has to stop him from destroying Hell's Kitchen. Are they? They'll never turn Karen Page into a porn star. They could do something else. Maybe she gets... they have her drink. She drinks kind of a lot on the show.
Yeah, she does.
So let's pitch it. She writes some story. She gets her facts wrong because she's a cubby reporter. And she gets like sued, you know, for libel.
Okay.
She crawls into the bottle and gets totally like laid out. So Matt kind of saves her in that way. She could, well, I'm not sure why she would sell his name to Fisk, but you work that out. Matt helps her recover, get back on her feet. Right?
Yeah. I think that could totally happen. I'm just so pissed all that they killed Ben Urich.
Okay.
I was so pissed when they did it, regardless of the story, because Ben Urich is such,
There's so much more you can do with that character. And they found such a great actor to play him.
I know. And it's like,
gotta kill the black guy.
Thank you. That's also what I was thinking. Just pisses me off.
Yeah. Well, back to this story. Nuke parachutes. Hell jumps into Hell's Kitchen, starts blowing everything up. Daredevil is there to fight him and swings into action. And you get that great thing where the cost is immediately super high.
Yep.
The stakes are super high, and they accomplish that by having Daredevil knows how bad this all is.
Yes.
You know, over the course of these two issues, when Nuke like ends up attacking, he knows everybody who's died. Like, he kicks Nuke's gun and it goes off, and for us it's just a stray shot, and Dee Dee knows that it went through that window and killed an old lady in the building over there.
Right.
And so he has to like take this guy down. He has to stop this before it gets any worse.
Right.
And he tries all his tricks. He, you know, tries to hit the nerve centers and like knock him out and like maybe break a rib. And it's clear this guy's superhuman. So I think he does an audible and he just kicks him off a roof.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, for me, separates him from Batman. Batman doesn't want to kill anybody. Daredevil wants to keep everybody safe.
Yeah.
And Daredevil's going to do what he has to do to keep everybody safe.
And that might include killing.
This guy kills 100 people in Hell's Kitchen. Nobody's going to say boo if Daredevil like pushes him off a roof.
Right.
And that's what he does.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't kill him.
No.
He just keeps going.
Yep.
So Ben Urich's kind of narrating this whole thing, describing how cool Daredevil is. And
Glory's continuing to take pictures.
She's just taking pictures.
Yep.
and Matt jumps down, grabs the guy's gun. And this whole time, this helicopter that has dropped Nuke off is still flying around, also shooting things.
Yes.
And so eventually it shoots Glory. She goes down and Matt's like, we're done. And shoots a rocket out of the gun, blows the helicopter up, kills the guys in the helicopter.
Yep.
He's not Batman.
No, he's not.
He's not Batman.
Mm-mm.
That pretty much takes care of that. Nuke's kind of down, helicopter's down, and the Avengers arrive.
Yep.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for
nice
helping.
Response time.
Yeah. I think that's...
And this is where they introduce Captain America.
Yes.
Who becomes part of the commentary, I mean part of the story in this part of the book. They basically send Nuke back to his owners. Captain America shows up at S.H.I.E.L.D. going like, so what was the deal with that thing? They're like, don't worry about it, Cap.
It's above your pay grade.
Yeah. And then Cap does a thing that I think they kind of borrowed for the Avengers movie, where he goes, if you're not going to tell me, I'm just going to find out myself.
Yeah.
And he like beats up a guard and goes, hacks a computer. You know, computer's moving a little slow for me. Like that scene in Avengers. And he finds out that Nuke is part of the Weapon Plus program or whatever, the same super soldier Project Rebirth that created Captain America. So bad news. He knows that's bad news. He goes and finds Matt. And Matt at this point is not sure where he is with the superhero community. They don't fight though, but he basically just says, he's one of ours. This is a problem. You know, I'll try to help you out, but you got to do what you got to do.
Right.
In the meantime, the diner's exploded and Matt gets an idea. This is where things start to get rushed because you could make a whole issue out of this. But Matt goes, well, I'll just like rob the Kingpin's money. I'll just take it and then I can pay the people at the diner. One new diner. Boom.
Right.
It's like, all right, that's a little morally gray. But we don't have time to deal with that because Nuke escapes, basically, out of the S.H.I.E.L.D. facility. And has
of course he does.
Kind of running battle with Captain America that peters out. We don't get really Nuke's. We know that he wants to save our boys and America.
Yep.
But he's fighting Cap, and then he's sort of, Cap's trying to help him because he's trying to get him away from these people.
Yeah.
We don't really know where he's at. A helicopter comes back. It's all helicopters in this book.
Yep.
Tries to kill Cap. Daredevil comes in and saves him, but Nuke gets hit. At this point, at no point has he been vulnerable to conventional weaponry, but apparently he can be shot by a helicopter. Captain America holds everybody off, and Daredevil gets this guy in a cab. It's like, we're getting to the hospital.
Yeah.
But Nuke basically just dies on the way, and Dee Dee decides, okay, he's dead. There's one more purpose he can still serve, though. Spins around, takes him to the Daily Bugle, and then we get another triangle.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're starting to see how this works. Well, but it's a great panel, though.
It is.
That's in every... If you look at Nuke on Marvel Wikia or whatever, you will see this panel where he just puts Nuke on Ben Urich's desk. Ben Urich's like in the middle of getting up like, what is this? There's your story.
Oh my gosh, you just right put about a corpse that. On my desk.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that is pretty much the beginning of the end for Kingpin as far as this little caper goes. His generals were right. His literal generals in his pocket are being investigated. It's all coming back to Kingpin. It doesn't look good for him.
Yep.
And he knows that he has created a new deadly enemy in Matt Murdock. Somebody who was a fly before is a hawk now.
Yeah.
Is something to worry about. And Matt and Karen are just walking around, just hanging around.
Yep.
And having fun in Hell's Kitchen.
Yep. And
you don't know. You don't know at this point. Again, for me, this could have been the end of Daredevil.
Sure.
Why not just be Matt Murdock?
He could just be Matt.
Later on in the pages of the book, he opens a storefront law clinic, like a pro bono law clinic for the people in Hell's Kitchen. He's very much more into the community and trying to be not above it, you know, just right in it now. But he goes back to, you know, being Daredevil eventually and all that stuff. But now he's kind of more comfortable. In comics now, everybody basically knows he's Daredevil.
Sure.
And so he can just be himself. He can not use a cane and he can like, I'll help you, ma'am. Just use his powers in the public. And I feel like if Miller had stayed on and had the idea, you could have picked it up from here.
Mm-hmm.
It's ground level reintroduction, reinvention of the character.
Absolutely. Yeah. It absolutely does. And you don't really know what's going to happen with Matt and with Karen and with any of these characters at the end of this book. And yeah, they're happy right now. But as we saw at the beginning of the story, that could change within a matter of just a couple of events, you know, very quickly.
Right.
And
I like the fact that there is no magical retcon. There's no Professor X wipe my name from his mind.
No.
Like, we continue on with this new paradigm. Like, we're here now.
Yeah.
Kingpin knows who Murdoch is, although he's not going to try anything anytime soon because he knows that this is a deadly foe. But there is a new sort of heightened level of like detente between the characters.
Yes. And Kingpin has this one line. He's recounting all the stuff that has happened. And he's like, well, at least I took that from him. I took the law from him. But you kind of sense that's not going to be totally true.
Yes.
You know, that Matt's going to find a way, because obviously he was framed, and he's going to be able to practice law again, and that's not going to be taken away from him anymore.
So. Yes. That's true. They actually do sort of get back to this, sadly.
Okay.
There is another series that takes place a couple years later in continuity called Last Rites.
Okay.
And it's basically sort of, it's like Born Again for the Kingpin.
Okay.
It's written by Dan Chichester and penciled by Lee Weeks, two guys who are on the book for a long time and got the book canceled, basically.
You do not seem excited about this.
They are not very good.
Okay.
And whenever you do a anniversary issue, you always have to talk about Chichester and Weeks. And I just wish that you didn't have to. It's like George Lucas. We're all glad that he's gone now.
Yes. Thank you for creating this thing.
Maybe
now please get your Weeks jam
hands
Chichester off.
Did something amazing like in their first couple issues.
Sure.
But we'll always have to mention George Lucas when we talk about Star Wars. Well, the mouse will take care of that eventually. But but they did a flip on this. Basically, like, Daredevil does a Kingpin on Kingpin. So okay. Daredevil has this sort of ruthless multi-part plan that is going to frame the Kingpin or, like, bring stuff to light, you know, that he did.
Sure.
And it involves the Billy Club that Kingpin, you know, planted in the cab that beat the cabbie to death.
Where does he get? He goes so, into the ocean or something?
Well, yeah, because they bring the cab up. And so it turns out he's been hiding this Billy Club because this cabbie's death is still unsolved. It's got Matt's DNA on it and the cabbie's DNA. So he's got this like locked up and he's going to use it against Daredevil. But it turns out that Dee Dee knew the entire time. And he does some kind of like diabolical underhanded things. Like he uses Typhoid Mary like against him by kind of lying to her. We haven't got to her yet, but don't worry about
it.
And sort of sets up this trap, and the whole thing's like, who cares? You thought it was cool to sort of revisit this thing and have a character play out of type, but you don't do it in a way that leads to anything new. What are you gonna get rid of the Kingpin?
No.
Of course not. Kingpin?
Of course you're not gonna get rid of the Kingpin. He's Daredevil's greatest foe. And
it's dumb.
And it you
gonna replace him with Madcap?
No.
No. Stiltman? Maybe. No.
Somehow I don't think so. I don't think you're going to replace him with Gladiator either. So, yeah. I mean, we've talked about this before, and I think this is just something that most people agree with. Like, you can't have a really great hero without having a really great villain.
Right.
And, I mean, can you have Kingpin without Daredevil or vice versa? I don't know that you can.
I don't know either. You sometimes do, and often the Daredevil as a book revolves around the Kingpin, you know, almost as much as it does around himself.
For sure.
There are a lot of storylines, even recently in like Bendis's run. They always do a thing where, oh, the Kingpin's betrayed by his people and they kick him out, and then he's like, no, oh, I'm just gonna live by the ocean and fish and, you know, raise puppies or something. And then he's like plotting to come back.
Of course he is.
Or he and Matt have to join forces against some other, the Rose or some other crime lord or something like that. So they always toy with that. But I do think that it's always seems like it's going to come back to this, you know, the classic sort of battle between them. To the point where often now when Daredevil, you know, infiltrates... there's always a scene where it's like the scene with Gordon's working late at night.
Sure.
And he's like, Jim, I've got to talk to you.
God, stop doing that.
I wish you wouldn't do that, Batman.
Yeah.
It's like, well, let me tell you about this. It's like, well, should we do the... it disappeared on me again.
Yes.
In Daredevil, that scene is Fisk is working late at night and he's like, I hear a thump outside my door. And it's like, here we go again. He opens the drawer, you know, reaching for the gun. Don't bother, Kingpin. You know, it's Matt's there. And they have a conversation, and they don't even fight or anything like that. It's like, I know you're into this somehow. It's like, I am a legitimate businessman.
Right.
And I don't appreciate that. He's like, you watch your ass. And he's like, I got to get better guards. You know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think that's always going to be a part of this.
Right.
Unless it's the show. And Kingpin's a good guy, I guess.
I mean, I don't know. I liked that, but I do think I agree with you. It would have been better to maybe wait to do that in a later season or so.
Yeah.
But so we get the character a little bit more established first. But,
would you recognize, would you recommend this?
Absolutely, 110%. This is an amazing graphic novel. I really enjoyed reading it the first time I read it, and I enjoyed rereading it. I just think it's fantastic storytelling by Miller and Mazzucchelli.
Yeah.
And I think this is just, I mean, this is a classic graphic novel in every sense of the word. And
well, trade paperback. But it totally works as a graphic novel.
Yes. And I think it's, I think everybody who's into comics should read this.
Yeah, I agree. This is probably hands down my favorite comic storyline. And that's rough. I mean, there's a lot of choices.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things that I think other things do better. If you put a gun to my head and forced me to criticize it, it'd be really hard. I think I might go after Miller. But even Miller in his excess, it's still working for this.
Sure.
And he isn't in his full-on horse, like excess. When he's doing it at this time, you might read it and go, that's kind of a lot there, Frank. But it all serves this comic, and it's comic code's on it, but it really pushes, like, I think where you could go with the comic code. I mean, having a smack addicted porn star, like,
Be that's the cause pushing the
boundary of more than a few murders. That's some Ed Brubaker stuff. But he pulls it off.
Yeah.
Criticism. There's some points where Mazzucchelli's stuff feels like a little. Not rushed necessarily. Like we said, he's not the most detailed artist.
Sure.
There's a few things that maybe it's not his style, but if he'd spent a little more time sort of fleshing out, would give it a more sort of gritty feel.
Sure. Because
it definitely looks like a comic book, which is fine. But in the right hands, you know, parts of it look great. And I wish that it all looked great. All of it looks pretty good.
Okay.
But I wish the whole thing looked great.
Yeah.
And that first issue, though, I don't think they even bothered, because it's Mazzucchelli in that issue, too. But I don't think they even bothered to, like, restore it or like kind of keep it the way it is with his art. Maybe he didn't work as hard on it, but it's a marked difference. And in the trade paperback that we had, this printing, it's all that computer colored and it looks horrible. And I hadn't read it in a while, and I thought, like, I couldn't remember if the whole thing was like this, but I was reading that first issue and I was like,
you're just mad.
Because I was not reading my physical copy. I got a digital one for this. And
right.
I was like, if the whole thing is like this, I'm going to be so mad. And then I turned to, oh no, it's fine. It looks the way it's supposed to. But for a second there, I was going to fly to New York and give Dave a piece of my mind. But yeah, I wish he worked in comics more. And I'm going to go check out some of his other stuff.
Okay. That sounds good.
We'll definitely do year one on the show someday.
Oh, year one's a great book, too.
But let's do some DC. Let's talk Constantine. We're going to talk Constantine as a film for Crafted Services on our next show. But let's do a classic Constantine storyline for next comic book club. Let's do Dangerous Habits.
All right.
It's issues 41 through 46 of Constantine, the original Vertigo comic book. In this, Constantine, occult magician and con man, finds out that he is dying of lung cancer. His beloved silk cuts have finally done their job, and he does not have long for this world. And for a guy who has trafficked quite a bit with demons and made a lot of enemies in hell, that's a bad situation to be in.
That is a bad.
Worse than most. Dying will be the best part of what's going to happen to him. It's where he goes after that's going to be the real problem. And so the shufflinest, tap dancinest, shuckin' and jivinest occult magician there ever was rolls up his sleeves of his trench coat and gets to work. And we'll see how that turns out when we read Constantine 41 through 46 next time on Comic Book Club. Ooh, child. Things did get better.
Yes, they did.
They can't get that great, though, right? We got a young blood after this.
Okay.
We've been eating all the dessert first.
You think so?
Yes.
Well, I mean, we have been talking about some pretty great stuff.
Yes.
So
we got to go back to talking about bad stuff. That's how we made our bones.
I know, right?
There's nothing to complain about.
Yeah, this is true. That's hard. It's rough when there's nothing to complain about.
It's so tough
about
that everything's so great.
Yeah.
Mad.
Oh, I'm so mad. It's so good.
Next time on movie segment, Transformers.
Oh, no.
The Mark Wahlberg one.
No.
I'm an inventor, you know? I found this giant robot. It turns into a car. I'll never understand. King Arthur?
Say hi
to your mother for me.
No.
Grain, right?
Oh, my gosh. Arthur's mother.
Trivia. Trivia and fun facts on Just Enough Trope. To find more trivia and fun facts about us, you can see us on our social media offerings like Facebook, and check us out there and on Twitter as well. You can also find us on iTunes. If you go to Just Enough Trope on iTunes, you'll find our page. Subscribe while you're on our page, because that's the best way to get the show. The second that it's ready, and it's usually ready on time, we keep a pretty good schedule.
Yeah, I think so.
Mostly.
Yeah.
There will always be a show at the beginning of the week.
Yes.
There will always be a show at the end of the week.
Yeah.
And that never falters.
No, it doesn't.
Unless we take a break.
But then we would let you know.
Because we deserve a break.
Gosh dang
sometimes,
it.
Sometimes, McDonald's. But when we're not having a break, the show comes immediately to you then. And when you listen to it, then give us a review. We'd appreciate hearing from you, how you think the show is going. And I got to say, we don't say this very often, but share us with a friend. If you enjoy the show, you like some of the things we talk about, you know people who like things like, oh, I don't know, Daredevil movie show or comic book.
Right.
Even the Transformers, even if they like that. Or if they like bad Mark Wahlberg impressions, let them know. If they're a podcast listener, they'd probably really like us. If they're not, they might like just listening to us. You don't have to become a podcast head just because you like hearing two knuckleheads talk about the Canucklehead. Wolverine.
Wow.
Wolverine's the Canucklehead. And if you do that, you'd probably like this show.
Okay.
And if you do like this show, please give us a rating. When you give us a high rating, iTunes knows we're doing a good job. We move up in the ranks and everybody gets what they want. So give us 5...
Billy clubs?
Yeah.
All right.
With or without cabbie brain on them?
Oh, I think we have to go with. Don't we?
I think that's extra.
Oh, okay.
I think you have to pay extra for the cabbie brain.
Okay.
Aside.
All right.
We'll just get it for the table.
Okay.
Just for the table.
Sounds good. Yeah, we'll share.
Who ordered the cabbie brains? I'm not paying for that. So just give us 5 stars so no cabbies have to die.
Okay,
we'd
sounds
appreciate
good.
That.
Yeah.
As we said on our next show, we're talking our craft to services segment, our quote-unquote bad movie segment, where we talk about movies that are low-rated but well-remembered. And we're talking about Constantine.
That's right.
That's kind of got a comic theme going on right now. 2005's Constantine, starring Keanu Reeves as John Constantine. Go figure. Very contentious in some circles, and we'll get to that when we talk about it. I'll say this about it, and I won't give away whether it's good or bad, we like it or don't. It's pretty fully, it's a romp.
Yeah,
it
is.
I think it's fully realized. Mm-hmm. They make a lot of changes, and I think they commit to them. But that's a little preview of what our discussion will be. And then if you want to keep following up on that, you can read issues 41 through 46 of Hellblazer. I called it Constantine before.
The
book is called Hellblazer.
The character is Constantine.
Yes. So I'm not a dummy. Give me my cred back. But it is called Hellblazer. you can read those, and we'll talk about that storyline, Dangerous Habits, on our next show, on Friday show, when we talk Comic Book Club again. Whew, I think we've done enough damage for tonight, so we are going to sign off. Until the next show, I'm your host, Caliban.
I'm your co-host, Mikan Hanna.
Keep the geek fires burning.